I'm D.D. Guttenplan, editor of The Nation magazine, and this is See How They Run. Here on See How They Run, we're going to try something a little different. Instead of avoiding the kind of obsessive attention to polls and punditry that are often derided as horse race coverage by political scientists and high-minded commentators, we're going to lean into all of it. Think of it as horse race coverage from the left. On today's segment, we'll be taking a look at the Republican Party, which over the past 8 years has completely transformed itself from the party of Richard Nixon and the Bushes to a wholly owned subsidiary of the Trump Organization. Joining me for that will be John Nichols, national political correspondent for The Nation and the author of several books. His latest, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, is the New York Times bestseller, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism.
John, it's okay to be angry about capitalism, but what about the Republican Party?
Oh, I think we can be angry about it as well.
The Republican Party changed from the party of East Coast big business, but still socially liberal on lots of issues, when Richard Nixon invited the Dixiecrats into the party. But how did we get from there to the party of Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, and then the party of Donald Trump? Because after all, Ronald Reagan and Barry Goldwater were both considered extreme in their day.
That's exactly right, Don. And I think what happened was that the Republican Party began to experiment with extremism. And you could even trace some of that back going maybe even to Joe McCarthy. And they saw that it gave them a resonance with voters that they had not previously been attractive to. And this was a big deal for Republicans because they had that image, as you suggest, of an East Coast sort of elite party, the Main Street business party, things like that. But they didn't necessarily have an appeal to working class voters. And that had really cost them politically for decades. Working class voters tended to be with the Democrats, especially after Roosevelt onward. And so they were looking for ways to get in there. And clearly, Goldwater, Nixon, Reagan saw that playing with the issue of race was one that worked for them, and driving wedges of division worked for them, and they experimented with it in all sorts of different ways. Remember, Reagan was, considered extreme, and in his 1980 campaign began campaigning by doing a lot of signaling to Southern conservatives, right?
Including beginning in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
That's exactly right. And because as recently as 1976, Carter had done very, very well in the South as the Democratic nominee. He'd won a lot of those states. And so Reagan wanted to drive that wedge. He was successful in doing so. And yet, at the end of the day, the Democrats kept figuring out ways to kind of counterbalance it and come around and to remain competitive. And so you saw the Republicans continue to experiment in this area. And with fits and starts, but I think that really the huge transition point came in 2015 and 2016. It was a big change because Donald Trump basically ran not just against the Democrats, as Republicans had for a long time. He ran against the Republicans.
Well, that's right. I mean, you remind me, John, that I was at the Republican summer meeting in 2015 when the debate moderator said, "Hold up your hand if you don't promise to support the Republican nominee." And Donald Trump held up his hand. So he was clearly marking himself out from the field. But what is it about either his political style, his ideology, or his background? Because after all, Ronald Reagan was a divorced man who courted Jerry Falwell and what we called in those days the Christian right. The Bushes were perfectly happy to do racial signaling. What made Trump such a break? What made him different?
I think that Trump was very, very blunt about kind of breaking all the rules of American politics. He had a line that he used in 2015, 2016 a lot, where he said, "We don't have time for political correctness." And, you know, it seemed like a throw-off line, but I don't think it really was for him. I think for him, it was a way of saying, "I'm not going to be polite. I'm not going to do even as the Bushes did with talking about kinder, gentler, or compassionate conservatism. I'm just going to go straight on in to saying things that were considered unacceptable in American politics by Democrats and even by most Republicans." Remember, he ran against pretty much every prominent Republican in the party at that point. You had a Bush running. You had governors from various states. You had senators, prominent senators running.
Little Marco.
Yes.
Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz, Scott Walker. I mean, the stage was packed. Even Rand Paul was in that race. And what Trump did was he said, you know, take a look at these people. Take a look at all of them. They've all lied to you. They've all promised you a whole bunch of right-wing policies. But then when they get in power, they govern, you know, pretty much as they choose. And what Trump basically suggested was, give me power and I will give you the Republican Party you want, right? He was essentially going over the party establishment, going over the party leadership, trying to speak directly to a base, maybe not the whole Republican base, but a base.
Well, that's a good question. Was it a base or was it different components?
I think it was different components, but with different messages. Remember, part of Trump's message early on was that I'm a businessman. I know how to run things, right? That had a huge appeal to a certain portion of Republicans. There was also, interestingly, the suggestion that he was a New Yorker and somehow he'd ultimately be a more liberal person than people expected. And remember that in the New York primary, or before the New York primary, Ted Cruz was attacking Trump for having, quote unquote, New York values, right? And that was a signaling that Trump was some kind of liberal.
And that he might be particularly soft on abortion.
Yes, exactly. So there's a host of things there. And none of this worked because I think what Trump did was he, again, always spoke directly to the most angry Republicans. Not the Main Street folks, the most angry Republicans across the country. And he said, look, you nominate me, there's not going to be any politeness. I'm going to be rough on immigrants. I'm going to be rough on refugees. I'm going to be rough on political correctness. I'm going to really do, you know, all the things that Fox News tells you you should be thinking about. Now, why this mattered, right, is that he did drive a wedge and he freaked out a lot of the Republican establishment. You saw that during that primary campaign in 2016. And many of them said, well, I'll never back Trump, or I can't stand Trump, or something like that. But what Trump understood, and this is a big deal with both major parties in the United States, because we have such a rigid two-party system, when you get control of a political party, even if you're coming from the edge of that party or from an angry base within that party, you then get most of that party's overall base, the broader base, to come on board with you because ultimately they are still loyal to that brand.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that and let's unpack that a little bit, because I remember thinking when Trump held up his hand, and I even wrote at the time, that I didn't think there was anybody on that stage who could beat him. But yet I didn't think he was going to be the nominee because I assumed that somebody who refused to support the nominee would have been expelled from the primary process mm-hmm. by the party. Mm-hmm. So how did he get this grip over the party? What were the points at which the party caved in rather than stood up to him? Why did they do that? What was in it for them? Mm-hmm. I mean, eventually they got the White House, but
yeah.
that was hard to see in 2016,
of course,
particularly early in 2016.
Yeah. And look, here's the thing. Trump understood that the base of the party, or at least a substantial portion of the base of the party, hated the leadership. And the leadership didn't know that. They didn't know how hated they were. And that's only become clearer over time. And what happened was, as Trump knocked out one kind of dynamic leader of the party after another, right? He knocked out Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush may not have been that dynamic, but he knocked out Scott Walker. He knocked out Ted Cruz. He knocked out Marco Rubio, one after another, John Kasich, everybody, just knocked them all out. The party leadership began to realize, I think, that they didn't have nearly the grip on their party that they thought they had. And they started to get very scared. And instead of uniting against Trump or trying to unite in some way against Trump, they recognized that it was going to be hard to beat him, right? That he was winning primaries, key primaries, and building up this base. And they decided, I think, that okay, we can't beat this guy, but we can probably manage him. And so a lot of the Republican leadership then began to adjust to the reality of Trump, thinking that he didn't know much about politics. He wasn't really a veteran political player. And so, okay, he's got something going on out there. He's good at attacking Hillary Clinton. He's good at, you know, some of this stuff. All right, swallow hard. Let's let him be the nominee. much as we don't necessarily like it. And remember, nobody wanted to be his vice president. He had to go out and find Mike Pence. But let's let him have this, and then we'll coalesce there. We'll see if we can figure out a way to get through this. I think a lot of the Republican leaders actually at that time, a good portion of them probably thought they were going to lose anyway.
So they thought, let him take the rap.
Exactly.
But there's something else you said that I think is really interesting, which is that the party base hated the leadership, but the leadership didn't know it.
Yep.
And I think this is where the Tea Party comes into it, because the Tea Party was the constituency of the base who hated the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, partly what made the Republican Party distinctive at the time and very different from the Democratic Party is that it had an organized ideological base. But one of the things that puzzled me then and still puzzles me is Ted Cruz was supposed to be the Tea Party candidate.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did Trump, as it were, steal the base?
Well, because Ted Cruz is a horrible politician, right? I mean, he's not good at what he does. Look, he's won in Texas, but even there, he runs behind the Republican ticket, right? He's not very good at what he does. And I think that Trump realized something very early on, that he could target any of these candidates he was running against, even Ted Cruz, and he could say, look at this guy. Do you really trust this guy? And, you know, that's standard political tactics, except that Trump was willing to go to places that no one had ever imagined. I mean, he's talking about Ted Cruz's dad, you know, being a conspirator on the Kennedy assassination. He's attacking Ted Cruz's wife. It was brutal and weird. And yet what you understood was, again, going back to that core point, the Republican base hated the leadership. They felt that they were always let down by the leadership, that they'd get power. They'd put all their energy into electing a Bush or electing, you know, a Bush or another Bush. Right. And that at the end of the day, they'd get screwed. They wouldn't get what they wanted. And Trump played on that, and he transferred it from the people who had been in power, like a Bush, to even a Ted Cruz or even a Marco Rubio, these younger leaders who seemed to be coming up on the right. And it was just incredibly effective. He basically said that he alone could be trusted, and that all the rest of them, you pick any of these other players and they are going to let you down. They're going to not deliver for you.
So there's an interesting term from nuclear strategy or geopolitics that describes what Trump did, which is escalatory dominance. And that's essentially, you know, you keep upping the ante, and you up the ante with brutality and force.
Yes.
So, you know, somebody lobs a cannon shell at you, you drop a 2,000-pound bomb. That's always been Trump's tactic in any dispute. I remember him acting that way in New York City real estate fights back in the 80s. But what I want to pivot to here is how this is going to play out in 2024.
Okay.
Because he's not running against Ted Cruz, and he can't run against the Republican Party anymore because he is the Republican Party.
Right.
So how does that change things, or does it?
Well, it doesn't change things too much. It kind of works for him, right? Because he has made the Republican Party his plaything, right? It extends from him. The notion now that there is a Republican opposition to Donald Trump is absurd. There isn't, right? It's the Republican Party, party of Trump. And there may be people who are conspiring or thinking about the future, right? Maybe there's some future beyond Trump someplace down the line. But at this moment, nobody is seriously standing up to him. And
well,
so,
including Nikki Haley,
who just endorsed him. Yeah. And you see this with members of Congress, right? Members of Congress who, if you meet them in the halls of the Capitol, come across as very reasonable, very thoughtful. They read the papers. They read the New York Times. Some of them even know The Nation magazine, right? And yet, boy, when you get them out there on that platform, what does Trump say? I'm for that. And so he's united the party into an extension of him. Effectively, the Republican Party is almost a non-entity, right? It is just a vehicle that Trump uses at this point. He's even using it to fund his trials, right? And his legal troubles. And so as a result, now he's got the party, to the extent that it exists, pretty unified around him. And so then he's able to take that energy and move it into the broader political sphere. And that's one of the things that comes from having control of a political party. Again, go back to this core point. We have a two-party system. I happen to favor multi-party democracy. I wish we had a more diverse system. We don't. And so as a result, when you get control of one party, when you get real control of it, then if you've got that level of unity, you can go at the other party. And if you're very aggressive, again, using some of the examples and thoughts that you've used and how, and sort of the strategies on this, then you take that into the November election as a, you know, a battering ram, right?
So that gives rise to the media's role. The media clearly normalized Trump in 2016. It took forever for major mainstream or news organizations to use the word lie, mm-hmm. despite the fact that his relationship to the truth was glancing at best fairly often. But, you know, this has continued even with them even with NBC trying to hire Ronna McDaniel as a commentator. So, you know, is there something that the media, I'm not asking you to indict the media in the past. I'm saying, how do you cover this kind of asymmetrical warfare in a way that isn't, that is, if you're an objective news organization, which luckily we at The Nation don't have to be, but most people get their news from organizations that pretend to be objective. So how do they handle this?
Well, I mean, they're still struggling with things you talked about, Don. I mean, they now can use the word liar, I guess, but they still struggle with the word fascist, right? They still struggle with the word authoritarian often. And so the fact is that the media has never figured out how to cover Donald Trump. And Trump knows that. And so as a result, he gives them a show. What does Donald Trump do after every day in one of his trials, like his New York trial? He goes out and gives him a little press conference every single day. And so what do you remember from that trial? All the talking heads saying what happened inside the courtroom and writing some bad drawing of a judge or a lawyer or something like that. And then you got live Donald Trump, right? And so he is still mastering the media. He is still figuring out how to put aside everything that's said and basically present himself directly as he can. I think media's gotten better at it a little bit. You know, they're not giving him, you know, live, beginning to end coverage of his rallies as the cable channels did in 2016. But they're still they're deeply fascinated by the guy, and they know that when they put him on, he tends to get attention. And so here we have a moment when you and I know. And Don, you've been so great on this, right? You've made sure that The Nation actually has covered, for instance, Gaza and issues like this at a deep and fundamental level. And boy, when I go out across America, I hear people talking about it all over the place. But when I turn on the cable TV channels, as an example, every night, what do I see? Wall-to-wall Trump trial, right? And I'm not saying you shouldn't cover the Trump trial. I think that's important. But I do think that we have this dynamic where everything is so deeply rooted in Trump's personality or his personal problems rather than his stance on the issues.
Doesn't that also include the opposition? Don't you have lots of liberal Democrats praying for the court to deliver us?
Yeah, and it's not going to happen.
But, no, we agree it's not going to happen. Whether he's acquitted or convicted, it's not going to happen. The court is not going to deliver us from this. But my question is, you have Trump, who practices escalatory dominance, who always brings a gun and sometimes a machine gun to a knife fight. And then you have the Democratic Party who bring, I don't know what, a credit card to a knife fight.
I mean, let me give you a good example. I was just writing about this for this week in The Nation. The state of Ohio has a rule that says you have to have your candidate nominated by August 7th. The Democratic Convention isn't until mid-August. And so there's a problem. How do you get Biden on the ballot? So the Republicans in Ohio are being jerks about this. They're like making it hard to give an extension, which they've done in the past year, cycle after cycle, but they're not doing it this time. So what's the Democratic response? Oh, we're going to have a virtual roll call, right? We're going to suck the life out of one aspect of our convention. And then, I'm sure that they...
Meaning they're going to do that before the convention.
Yeah. So the nominating convention of a national party isn't going to nominate because the nomination will already have been done. Why? Because
to satisfy Ohio Republicans.
Right, exactly. And then do you think, how far are we from then having a virtual platform debate or a virtual this or a virtual that? And what the Democrats too frequently do is say, wow, those Republicans, they're really bad guys. We'll expose that they're bad guys, but then we'll do kind of, we'll get into the corner they forced us into. And this country does not have a fighting Democratic Party, right? It doesn't have a Democratic Party that is, you know, really willing to go at it. What it has is a Democratic Party that has gotten so used, this goes back even to the Clinton era, has gotten so used to saying, we're not as bad as the other guys, right? And so trust us because we're just better managers. We're better, you know, we're a better bunch of people. And in a country where everybody's happy, that might work. But in a country where there is a lot of frustration, a lot of
frustration and desperation.
Discomfort, right?
And unhappiness. Not just, you know, not just frustration. A lot of people are hurting.
Exactly. And so, and unfortunately at this point, there's too much evidence that the Democratic Party's response is to say, you don't know how good you have it, right? If only you understood how good we are for you. Whereas, and this takes us back to the Republican Party and to Trump, which is our subject here. Trump knows to constantly up the grievance, right? And the Democrats have to understand that. They need to recognize that that's what Trump is going to do. His is a party of grievance. Trump ran, even in 2020, Trump was running against Trump, right? He's always running against government. Even if he controls it, he's against it, right? He's angry about something. And Democrats don't have to be that angry, but they do have to recognize that in this moment in our history, right, the counter to Republican grievance is an acknowledgement that some grievance is rooted in reality and that you have to talk about something bigger and bolder and better.
Well, bigger and bolder and better, or bigger and badder and worse.
Well, but what the answer is very, very simple, right? 2 days before the election in 1936, Franklin Roosevelt, son of privilege, born and raised in a wealthy family, right, is 2 days out from the election. It's a complex election. There's all sorts of things going on. We're still in a depression, stuff like that. What does Franklin Roosevelt say in his final major speech at Madison Square Garden? The bankers are against me. Wall Street's against me. They don't like what we're trying to do. I welcome their hatred, right? I mean, that's, I will not say that's a Trumpian line. I don't think Trump could ever get as creative a line as that. But the bottom line was that was taking anger and grievance into the politics, but directing it in the right way. Roosevelt directed it against economic power. And he people said, wow, that guy's a fighter. I mean, I can go for that. This is the challenge. In every campaign, there's a fighter and there's a manager. And depending on the dynamic of the country, sometimes the country chooses a manager. It's true. It happens sometimes. But if the country is uncomfortable, angry, frustrated, if there's difficulty, if there's pain, as you suggest, then there's a good chance the country goes for a fighter. And if you're not presenting yourself as such, you run the risk of being beaten, not on the issues and not on the record, but simply on a sense that that guy, or hopefully at some point that woman, will fight harder for me.
Well, John, this is a horse race podcast. So you want to give me odds on Joe Biden turning himself into a fighter? I'd say the odds are pretty slim.
They're very, very slim. Look, I think the Democratic National Convention is a really big deal. I think if the Democrats overmanage it and don't allow for dissent and don't allow for some real discourse, and frankly, don't allow for Biden to get some input on how to do this better, he runs a very real risk of going on kind of autopilot through a campaign to a fall campaign in which he's just not, you know, not showing the energy, not growing in the way he should. And at the bottom line, I don't care what his age is. That's irrelevant to me. The question is, can you learn? Can you evolve in the course of a campaign to meet the demands of that campaign? And that's what Joe Biden has to do. Now, you can love or hate Donald Trump. I mean, you have, think of him what you want. You think about what he's done to the Republican Party. But what you have to understand is Trump constantly evolves. You throw an issue his way, he'll jump all over it, right? I mean, he often does so in clumsy and evil and awful and ugly and terrible ways, but he's constantly on it, right? And, you know, he went the other day to the Libertarian Party convention. It was a disastrous appearance, but he tried it, right? You know, he's always trying something.
Well, also, he's always moving, just like a show.
That's what I mean. Yeah, yeah.
All right, John, we're going to leave it there, but thank you very much. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
It's a total honor to be with you, Don. Thanks for the conversation.
We've been talking about the transformation Donald Trump effected on the Republican Party and how he consolidated his hold on the party machinery. But now we're going to talk about the party base and about the kinds of groups that have been brought into the party and empowered by the Republican Party in recent years. And to do that, there's nobody better than Jeff Charlotte, whose book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power, started telling this story in 2008. And his most recent book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War, picks it up just last year. So, Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. Let's start with a little bit of history. What makes the religious right now different from the religious right in Ronald Reagan's day?
There's a couple of factors. One is it's sort of the convergence of what I used to describe as the avant-garde of American fundamentalism. And this was a group called the Fellowship or the Family. They run the annual National Prayer Breakfast, which every president since Eisenhower has attended. And so in that sense, that religious right, which was quite extreme, actually, in its inner theology, nonetheless understood itself as contending for power within an establishment. It did not imagine displacing the establishment. And in fact, it looked somewhat askance at its populist branch, you know, the Jerry Falwells, the Pat Robertsons, the TV preachers. And I think what happened for a number of reasons in the early 2000s, culminating in Trump, is the convergence of this kind of elite branch of Christian nationalism that had been mostly overlooked with the populist front, the TV preachers, the masses. And there'd always been a tension between these two groups. And I think that was sort of not understood in secular political spheres, that these groups were not neatly aligned. Trump really kind of marks the convergence of this. And I think of this in terms of when we ask ourselves, how do we come to this great right-wing moment that we're in? And I would argue it's a kind of a global fascist moment, not in the United States alone. I think we have to remember that, one, it's a social movement, that term doesn't belong to the left. There are good social movements and social movements I don't like, but that all social movements always mark this coming together of many different strands. Some of them maybe not so friendly to each other, in a moment where they come together through common interests. And I think that's what's happening. Well,
so as they say in the ballpark, you can't tell the players without a program. So talk us through a little bit. Who are the main groups here who people should know about?
Since 2016, it's the wrong question. Trump's genius, if you want to give him that, was the understanding that in 2016, there's an establishment Christian right. But in 2016, along comes Trump. And of course, you know, we all know the story, the thrice married grabber of genitalia. Right. And let's not forget that most of the Christian right leaders turn against him. They are not into this. And yet he quickly in those primaries starts just stacking up victories. And his great insight was to understand. And I use the word insight in the same way that we think of slime mold as having a plan for where it's going. It's really good at what it does. Is it consciously thinking this? I don't know. But Trump figures this out. And you really see it in that photograph that he released in 2016, and it shows a lot of preachers gathered around him, laying hands on him, praying over him. It's invoking actually an old tradition in kind of evangelical art. And millions of people look at that and they say, oh, the nation's Christian leaders are coming together. And he releases the names, Lance Wallnau, Paula White, and Christian right leaders, and are saying, who? What? Lance Wallnau, that D-list guy, Paula White, she doesn't do politics. What's going on here? And what he has figured out is he doesn't need any particular Christian right leaders. He just needs the type. He needs the imprimatur of Christianity put upon him. And that he can swat away those Christian right warlords very quickly. And he does. And so the leaders don't matter anymore. You saw it in 2016 again in the way that Trump, every rally, and the political press didn't cover this. And this drove me nuts. I would go to these rallies. Every rally was opened by a preacher, almost always a black or brown preacher for a mostly white crowd, which was doing all kinds of purposes. And for a mostly non-church going crowd, because we have to remember Christian nationalism is not actually about going to church. It's about an idea of a national destiny. They like it that it's a black preacher because they think that inoculates them against charges of racism. And you would look at the press pen, the press pen where the press were all gathered, and here's the preacher. What are they doing? They're looking at their phones. They're not paying attention. Trump's not religious, so we don't need to pay attention to that. Trump is building a religiosity outside of the old electoral blocks. And so in so many ways, the difference between the religiosity of the age of Reagan, which I would argue goes from 1980 to 2016, and the Trumpocene, which is now, is it used to be defined in the same way old school politics were, you know, like ward healers, who can deliver the votes. Trump has bypassed that middleman.
If Jerry Falwell likes you, you get all the votes from his corner of Virginia.
Yeah. And Jerry Falwell Jr. now, it doesn't matter if Jerry Falwell Jr. likes him. He did like Trump, but then he fell, and it doesn't matter because Trump's still getting all those votes.
I want to slow it down a little bit because I saw something in 2016. I was at the South Carolina Tea Party Convention, and that was supposed to be when Ted Cruz was anointed. Mm. He was definitely the favorite son coming into that. And I saw something in that room that was like watching Elvis at a Pat Boone concert, you know, that... They all knew that they were supposed to love Ted Cruz, and they all knew that Trump was bad, and they couldn't help it. They just couldn't help it.
And that's a perfect example, because Pat Boone actually was involved with the family, that establishment group of elites that I wrote about in The Family. And you see if you're a Pat Boone fan, Elvis is a kind of grotesque sexuality, and you can't believe that anybody will ever approve of him, and especially not decent people. But it turns out especially decent people love Elvis, and they love the license of that grotesque sexuality. And I think this is the transgressive moment that now more and more religious studies scholars are paying attention to, and journalists are paying attention to, and also digging deep past the veneer of piety that defined, say, the moral majority, the Christian right of the 70s, 80s, 90s. Let's go back much deeper into the history of Christianity and understand that there are times when it is not pious. He's drawing on another tradition, and it's an old tradition. And it's a transgressive tradition of violence, of the violent will take it by force, and even of crudeness. That's all there in the history. And it's now surging up, and it's just sort of washed right over that establishment Christian right.
All right. So I have two questions, and they may take us a long time to unpack. But the first one is the question that everybody should be asking about Trump, which is, in a sense, the question that German businessmen didn't ask themselves. They said, we can control this guy. So who's zooming whom here, with particularly in relationship to the religious right? What do they think in terms of what they're getting out of it, and what do they think in terms of control or not control? Who do they think is in charge?
The idea of who's running who, I don't think it makes much sense anymore. I will say this.
Because they're partners.
They're not even partners anymore. It's a singular movement. And this, again, is where I think that's why I use the F word, fascism. Whereas I would have argued, if we were talking 10 years ago, there's some on the left who would describe American power as fascist. And I would have argued, I would have said, look, there's more than one kind of bad under the sun. This kind of bad isn't fascism.
So what's changed? What makes this different? Why do you think the F word is where we need to go now?
Partly because of that merger, because it's no longer transactional, because it's no longer Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush with a Christian right constituency for which they're going to do X, Y, or Z over here, and their business constituency for which they're going to do A, B, and C over there. Part of which, but instead you have this merger, which brings us into a movement time where folks involved in it understand themselves as engaged not in the back and forth horse trading, but in a transformational moment.
So transformation rather than transaction.
Transformation rather than transaction. And then, of course, this movement still might not make it. I mean, it's here, but its full power is not inevitable. But he notes these details of, you know, the cult of personality, the I alone can fix it. The internal enemy, the other, which I think is very important. The left keeps on falling for the trap, because in 2016, the internal enemy for Trump were Muslims. Right. They might become so again. He's talking about that way. The internal enemy is always fluid. It can be anybody, and it will move. But I think, and of course we understand the sort of the nationalist relationship with capitalism, but I think the real tell is not just violence, because American empire always trades in violence, but pleasure in violence. Violence as a kind of transgressive pleasure. And you experience it at any Trump rally you go to. And it's where the political press really fell down. The political press in 2016 and 2020, and I think mostly now, would so often go to a Trump rally and they would pick the one or two extreme lines. I remember a rally I went to in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and Trump says something about, you know, 4 more years, 12 more years. He says, just watch. Tomorrow, that's the only thing that's going to be in the paper. Of course he was right. That was the only thing that was in the paper. What wasn't in the paper was the 15, 20 minutes he spent in this pornographic horror movie describing, he says, in Philadelphia, they're releasing these illegal alien rapists, and they're releasing them into the countryside. They're coming out. They're climbing through your windows. They're decapitating people. They're stabbing people in the hearts. They're cutting their hearts out. They're bad hombres climbing through the window of innocent sleeping wives while their husbands are away. And it's grotesque. It's violent, and it's titillating. It is sexual, and I'm putting that in quotes for the listeners there. These are rape fantasies. And it's also all framed in this idea of, I am telling the truth. I am naming the thing. Isn't it a release? And now I can speak honestly of what is to be done. I think of another rally, Youngstown, Ohio. This was the first rally I went to. This was back in early 2016. And this is the one where I said, oh, okay. This is the strongman figure that American evangelicalism has been supporting abroad come home. I was standing with this nice elderly couple. They looked so sweet. They looked like my grandparents if they were still with me. Kind of hippie-ish. And the man, Gene, says, I'd like to get a hold of one of those protesters. I'd beat the shit out of him. And then I'd get on TV. And his wife, at first, I think she's going to sort of look at him and like, you know, you've gone too far. And then she just sort of melts into him. Oh, Gene. And she just thinks, look at her sexy man talking about beating someone. And then Trump will come on the stage and say, we'll talk about beating people in the audience. And the joy and the cheers, that's a fascist move, right? The reverence for violence, the idea of redemption through violence, that you only become your true self. You're only being really honest with yourself. Let's admit it. We all want to do it. We all want to hit someone. He says what we really feel. The man understands archetypes in a way that is oddly not common for an American politics, which is all about parables and telling a little fable of a person you met in Iowa. Trump has done a different kind of work with archetypes.
Well, he's gone around that. But that brings us, you know, because we're here to talk about the horse race.
Yeah.
So if you have an opponent who, whether he's preternaturally gifted or uncannily political intelligent or just lucky, has found a way to get around the kind of, I met a guy on the supermarket the other day, Joe Biden relating to the common man story. And then you've got a Democratic Party that never fails, you know, to bring a memo to a knife fight. So what are they supposed to do?
Oh, I don't know. You're the editor of The Nation, man. I subscribe to your magazine to find out. I do think the first lie of fascism is inevitability. So, I mean, fascism presents itself as an inevitable force. And it's essential to remember always and at every turn that it's not true. And that can mean counting your victories, national or local, paying attention to your school board and discovering that the Moms for Liberty candidate didn't make it on in your town. And that's fantastic. It can mean even smaller things like that. And because I do think that anyone who says now, hey, here's how we beat fascism. Well, that person is selling snake oil. And you know they're selling snake oil because we haven't done it yet. Nobody knows how we beat fascism yet, which is why I believe in a popular front. You know, everybody try, all hands. I agree with you that the memo to the knife fight strategy so far is not working well. And, you know, we could get into sort of horse race debates and, the so-called hopium folks who sort of say, well, actually, when you split the points like this and that and that and the other and so on, and they lost sight of the fact, wait a minute, if you're talking about a full-fledged fascist, quoting Hitler, even being in the race, your hopium's out the door. We're now in dangerous territory. So what is the method? I don't know. It's also the fact that, you know, I do connect this, Don. I think about this. We're in this sort of extinction level media event. You go to a Trump rally now, and who's not there who was in 2020? You know, BuzzFeed, HuffPo, Salon's not sending people out anymore. The magazines are ghosts of themselves. Daily newspapers. This is an epic year for the death of newspapers. And the reason, one, we need more coverage, but also, you know what? You got one issue of The Nation. Here's an idea about what we do well. And then the next issue, people write letters and explain to you why you're absolutely wrong. And here's what we do. And here's what we do. And here's what we do. That noise of democracy, that constant conversation, we need to create the space for it to be found.
There are two things I want to ask you. So one is, you said it doesn't matter about factions. It doesn't matter which religious right you're talking about, because it's now, for Trump's purposes, all one thing. So how does that relate to the flag that Mrs. Alito flew in her yard?
Well, there's two flags. You're referring to the upside down flag that Mrs. Alito flew. At first reportedly in response to a neighborhood dispute, but of course now new reporting shows that she was flying that before that, and it seems much more in response to Biden's inauguration. And then another flag that they flew,
the appeal to heaven
at their summer home. And the appeal to heaven is this sort of a revolutionary era flag, much like the don't tread on me flag, which used to mean just sort of cranky libertarian and has increasingly become fascist. Around, I think, 2016, a Christian charismatic leader, that's a kind of Christianity, named Dutch Sheets, wonderful name, Dutch Sheets, who really, before Trump, was not a major player. He wasn't D-list, but he was B-list, maybe. And he embraces this flag as part of something called the New Apostolic Reformation. And you see this movement, the NAR, you'll see a lot of talk about it. I think we want to be careful about putting too much weight on the outlandish beliefs of any one faction within evangelicalism, because again, the masses, they don't know. They hold these ideas without even understanding where they came from them. The ideas are percolating out there. You want to pay attention to the great proliferation of flags. It's not just the appeal to heaven and the don't tread on me and the blue lives matter and the upside down American flag and the American flag without any stars. And then all the variations of Trump flags, Trump on a tank with a machine gun, Trump as Rambo. The flag.
Trump as Jesus.
Trump as Jesus. The flags in which the stripes and stars are replaced by long guns and handguns, respectively. Every flag is fracturing the idea of, okay, here is a vast democratic project. And I'm the last person. I'm not going to get sentimental about the stars and stripes. But it's worth noticing that they're not flying the American flag so much. They're flying other flags. They're insisting on a subversion and a transgression, which is exhilarating. The appeal to heaven is one more way of saying, I'm imagining a country that is not the old America, whether it's Barack Obama's America or Reagan's America or FDR's America, an America that you are in deep criticism of, America that you think has something of value. I am imagining a new world. This is a utopian movement. When they say make America great again, we like to take them to task and say, when was it great? We're missing the story, right? They know they are imagining a country that never was, that can come into being. And that's what those flags really stand for.
Here's the other question. What the right got from the first Trump term was the Supreme Court and Roe v. Wade. What do they get from the second term? And that's where I suppose you'd say it's not transactional. So this nature of the thing has shifted. So partly, what do they get from a second term, if you want to answer that? And partly, is there anything Trump could do or say now that would lose them?
I'll start with the second one, because I think the only thing that he could lose them on is guns. I think Trump could turn around tomorrow and say open borders, and he'd carry them. He's already said, I don't apologize to God. There's nothing to be lost there. Guns. And I think guns as a kind of, and that's a clue to the sort of the religiosity of Christian nationalism, which again is not about pious church going. But in terms of what the right gets, what Trump wants is the right now. Trumpism can pivot in any direction. What will happen though? We say, well, what we'll experience? Well, we have the outline of Project 2025, which we should all be paying attention to. And I know you all have written about, but we should also be, as always, taking him at his words. As Jamelle Bouie wrote in the New York Times recently, Trump is promising the greatest displacement of human beings since World War II, on par with the Indian-Pakistan partition, to drive out 15 million, as he puts it, illegal aliens, undocumented people, and of course, quite a few others swept up along the way. That's just for starters. Why we're not talking about what Trump is promising, big oil, why we're not talking about Trump and climate change and the last chance to even grasp for a better way, I don't know. Trump in 2016 campaigned with a story. It's from the Philippines, and it's a made-up story. General Black Jack Pershing in the United States fighting. And he says, he's in the turn of the century, he says, they've captured 50 Muslim rebels. And what does General Blackjack do? He takes 50 bullets and he swishes them in pig blood. And then one by one, he has 49 of them shot. And he gives to the last man the bullet soaked in pig blood. And he says, take this back to your people. This is what I have coming for you. When Trump told that story in 2016, the crowd roared with ecstasy. That's the dream. So what do we have coming? We've got this good old word for it. It's fascism. It's the real deal. And in every corner, in every aspect.
Jeff, you're terrific. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, Our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.